In 1926, Philadelphia held a World's Fair called the Sesquicentennial Exposition to mark the 150th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The enterprise was a fiasco from the start. The site chosen was marshy and difficult to build on. The vision for the fair was grand, but the funding meager. The state of Pennsylvania declined to contribute anything to the costs. Construction efforts fell so far behind that hardly any exhibits were finished when the fair opened on May 31, 1926. President Coolidge declined to attend and sent his Secretary of State, Frank B. Kellogg, and omnipresent Commerce Secretary, Herbert Hoover. The park that greeted them was embarrassingly incomplete. An 80-foot-high Liberty Bell, the exposition centerpiece, was still shrouded in scaffolding. Work hadn't even started on the New York State Pavilion. The tardiest exhibition of all was Argentina's, which was dedicated on October 30th, literally just in time for the exposition's closing. It rained almost all summer and into the fall, depressing crowds in every sense of the word. The exposition had just one successful event. On the evening of September 23rd, in a stadium otherwise rarely used, Jack Dempsey squared off against an up-and-coming young boxer named Gene Tunney in Dempsey's first fight in almost exactly 3 years. After Dempsey's long layoff, interest in the fight was huge. One reporter, with just a hint of excess, called it the greatest battle since the Silurian Age. The paid attendance was 120,000, but it is believed that as many as 135,000 packed in. Tunney was an intelligent boxer, but a light hitter, and it was widely agreed that he would be overwhelmed by Dempsey's power. In fact, Tunney fought a brilliant and perfect fight, jabbing sharply, then wheeling away from Dempsey's killer right hand. Dempsey stalked him all night, while Tunney stung him repeatedly with sharp but wearing jabs. The effect was cumulatively formidable. By the seventh round, Dempsey's face was a swollen mess. One of his eyes was sealed shut, and the other wasn't far behind. He chased Tunney all night, but managed to land just one good punch. Tunney won easily on points. When the bruised and puffy-faced Dempsey arrived home afterwards, his horrified wife asked what had happened. "Honey, I forgot to duck," Dempsey famously replied. Dempsey's defeat caused nearly universal dismay, but set the scene for the biggest rematch in boxing history. A small round of qualifying bouts was arranged as a way of maximizing excitement while milking the situation for every cent it would yield. The first qualifying bout was between Jack Sharkey and Jim Maloney. This was the fight, mentioned earlier, at which 23,000 people paused to pray for Charles Lindbergh, who was at that moment alone over the Atlantic. The winner of that fight, which in the event was Sharkey easily, would then face a grand qualifying match against the aging but formidable Jack Dempsey on July 22nd. The venue for both qualifying bouts was Yankee Stadium, a matter that naturally warmed the heart of Jacob Rupert. So as July dawned on America, in the week that Richard Byrd and his team splashed down in France, that New York suffered its first heat wave, that Calvin Coolidge celebrated his 55th birthday by donning cowboy apparel, that Charles Lindbergh took off for Ottawa, that Henry Ford's minions prepared his apology to Jews, and that the world's leading central bankers assembled in secret conclave on Long Island, the story that preoccupied the nation was how fit and eager Jack Dempsey was. Scores of reporters filed daily reports from his training camp at Saratoga Lake, New York, suggesting that he was looking menacing and resolute, and that his punches had a snap to them not seen in years. Then came terrible news. On the 2nd of July, a police car arrived at Dempsey's camp to inform him of a family tragedy. Dempsey's brother Johnny had gone increasingly off the rails in recent months, so much so that his young wife, Edna, had fled to the East with their infant child. Johnny Dempsey had tracked them down to a boarding house in Schenectady, just 20 miles from his brother's training camp, and there he had shot and killed Edna, then turned the gun on himself. He didn't harm their child. Jack Dempsey was devastated. The police drove him to Schenectady to identify the bodies. Then Dempsey returned to his camp, retired to his cabin, and would not respond to knocking, leaving everyone to wonder what would become of the fight. To universal relief, after 2 days of seclusion, Dempsey emerged from his cabin and grimly resumed training. In Paris, Commander Byrd's crew, their formal commitments dealt with, celebrated their last night in the city a little more colourfully than Lindbergh ever had. Bert Acosta, or sleek swart Bert Acosta, as Time magazine called him, took George Noville to some of the seamier night spots of Montmartre for an evening of jazz and cheerful abandon. Bernt Balchen was taken out for a drunken Viking evening by a group of Scandinavians based in Paris. Byrd declined to join either party and instead had an early night. Charles Levine and Clarence Chamberlain were in Paris at the same time, but seemed to have been somewhat excluded from the celebrations. Levine, belatedly realizing the importance of public relations, abruptly gave 100,000 francs, or $4,000, to the Aero Club de France to build a clubhouse at Le Bourget. He also called on Madame Neungesser, who was now getting more than a little creepy in her stout refusal to accept that her son was gone forever, and not afloat on the North Atlantic, surviving comfortably on fish that he and Coley hauled gleaming from the sea while awaiting rescue from a passing ship. Levine proposed to the other Atlantic flyers that they fly home together in their two planes, but the invitation was declined, partly because the Byrd plane was a wreck, it would never fly again, partly because a westward flight against the prevailing winds was insanely risky, and partly because no one wanted to be that close to Levine. Chamberlain decided that he'd had enough of Europe, and probably Levine, and would sail home with the Byrd team on the SS Leviathan in a few days. Levine had promised Chamberlain $25,000 for his part in their adventure, but in the end paid him much less than half that. A week after landing in French waters, the Byrd party travelled back to Normandy, to Le Touquet, where they had dinner with the Prince of Wales, then proceeded on to Cherbourg to board their ship home. Their sailing was given a giant three-deck headline and 5,000 words of coverage in the New York Times, as if it was in itself an act of heroism. Then things went eerily quiet, aviation-wise. With Byrd and his team at sea, Lindbergh locked away on Long Island writing We, and Levine talking mostly nonsense, there was nothing aeronautical left to write about. On July 12th, for the first time in 6 weeks, no aviation story led the front page of the Times. At the bottom of page one, however, was a small story so curious as to be worth mentioning. The previous day in Canada, according to an Associated Press report, a plane doing aerial survey work for the Canadian government had taken off from an airfield near Lake Manitoba. The plane carried a pilot, photographer, and surveyor. The weather was good. Several witnesses reported that the plane climbed to about 2,000 feet in a normal manner, but then, as it emerged from a cloud bank, and as onlookers watched in bewildered horror, the three occupants left the plane one after another and plunged to their deaths. What caused them to jump or fall is a question to which no plausible answer could ever be supplied. The main news by mid-July was of a new and more brutal heat wave that was settling over much of the nation. In New York on July 13th, the temperature rose to 91 degrees at 4 in the afternoon and broke 100 degrees elsewhere. By Saturday, July 16th, the number of deaths in the city attributed to the heat was 23, and throughout the East it was at least 60. In New York City, half a dozen of the victims drowned while trying to cool off. One lucky survivor was an 8-year-old boy named Leo Brzozowski, who was found floating in an inner tube 5 miles out in lower New York Bay. He had been in the water for at least 5 hours and was roughly halfway between Staten Island and Keensburg, New Jersey, when he was rescued by a passing motorboat. The boy was fully dressed, he was even wearing shoes, and was unable to explain why he had gone into the water fully clothed or how he had gotten so far from shore. Doctors said he was exhausted but would make a full recovery. On July 16th, a torrential afternoon downpour cooled things off but brought chaos too. Lightning knocked out power in several neighborhoods and killed a couple sheltering beneath a tree on Staten Island and a policeman on a street corner in Brooklyn. Trains to and from Coney Island were stalled by flooded tracks and short-circuited electrical systems, just as several hundred thousand people were trying to get home from the beaches. The rain caused much flash flooding. In Brooklyn, a 27-year-old man managed the unusual feat of drowning in his basement when 6 feet of water flooded in. The worst heat-related disaster of the summer was not on the East Coast, but on Lake Michigan at Chicago, when some 75 people, mostly women and children, crowded onto a commercial pleasure launch for a trip on the lake in the hope of catching a breeze. As the boat cruised just offshore, a squall blew up. The passengers merrily raced to the sheltered side of the craft to escape the driving rain, but this unbalanced the boat, and it capsized. 27 people drowned. Among those who rushed to the rescue was Johnny Weissmuller, not yet famous as Hollywood's Tarzan, but celebrated for having won 3 gold medals in swimming at the 1924 Olympic Games in Paris. Weissmuller happened to be on the beach at the time of the capsizing and reportedly recovered a number of bodies, both living and dead. The Leviathan arrived in New York in rain and fog on July 18th. Byrd and his crew, accompanied by Clarence Chamberlain, were transferred to the mayoral yacht, the Macomb, where they were surprised to find waiting for them, rather secretly, Charles Lindbergh. Byrd was clearly touched that Lindbergh had come to greet them, but also no doubt relieved that Lindbergh declined to join them for the afternoon on the grounds that this was their day and he didn't wish to be a distraction. Lindbergh was surely glad to let someone else have the world's attention for a day. As it was, the celebrations that followed were a little muted by Lindbergh's standards, though this owed at least as much to the sodden weather as to jaded public sentiment. Byrd and his men, accompanied by Chamberlain, were placed in open-topped cars for a parade up Broadway. Unfortunately, the heavens opened in a clattering torrent just as they set off, driving many thousands of onlookers to scatter for cover and leaving Byrd and his men as drenched as if they had swum ashore. At City Hall, a big viewing platform had been erected for a presentation ceremony, but about 100 of the chairs were conspicuously empty, and about half the crowd melted away during the speeches as the rain continued to fall heavily. A thought on many people's mind was whether the rain would ease for the Dempsey-Sharkey fight. Happily, it did. Though the air was thundery, the rain held off, and the fighters and spectators enjoyed a comparatively cool, dry evening on July 20th. 85,000 people turned out at Yankee Stadium, more than had ever attended a baseball game. But then for a boxing match, thousands of extra seats could be put on the playing field, and never mind that many in them couldn't see very much. And the gate of $1,250,000 was a record for a non-title fight. Among those attending were Mayor Jimmy Walker, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Cowboy star Tom Mix, the publisher Bernard McFadden, and the Maharaja of Ratlam, or very possibly someone who fooled the world into thinking he was a Maharaja. Two people who went almost entirely unnoticed in the crowd were Richard Byrd and Clarence Chamberlain. Sharkey was the 6-5 favorite, based largely on the consideration that he was 25 years old and on the rise, while Dempsey was 32 and all but retired. Sharkey was from Boston, the son of Lithuanian immigrants who had endowed him with magnificent strength and a name that no one could spell. It was variously rendered in official records as Zuhaske, Zuhaskas, Kokoski, and Kukokse, before he chose Sharkey as more sleekly American-sounding. He took Jack from his greatest hero, Jack Dempsey. The fight was disappointingly restrained. Dempsey was much less aggressive than of old. Sharkey dealt with his cautious attacks easily and led comfortably through the first 6 rounds. In the 7th, however, Sharkey did the most brainless thing a boxer can do. Frustrated by Dempsey's repeated low blows, he turned to the referee to complain, and Dempsey tagged him on the chin, knocking him out cold. Photographs show Sharkey dropped on the canvas like a discarded overcoat. Dempsey was declared the winner. He would now meet Gene Tunney in a rematch on September 22nd in Chicago. It would be the biggest fight in history, and the most controversial. An ecstatic Jacob Rupert announced plans to increase the seating capacity at Yankee Stadium by extending the decks down the left field line, which would let him accommodate 90,000 spectators at boxing matches. This news was greeted with a certain cynicism among newsmen, who pointed out that many spectators were already so distantly seated that it had been like watching a bout through an inverted telescope. As one reporter put it only semi-wryly, at the conclusion of the fight, hundreds of fans rushed from the stadium and bought late extras to find out what had happened. The next day, Sharkey was rushed to the hospital with severe internal bleeding. Happily, he made a full recovery, but it was a striking reminder that Dempsey, even in restrained mode, still hit with mighty force. On the afternoon following the Dempsey-Sharkey bout, Charles Lindbergh, now embarked on his national tour, arrived in Boston in an unusually perky fashion. Coming in to land at the recently opened Boston Airport, on the site of the present Logan Airport, he raced across Boston Harbor just above the waterline, then at the last possible instant shot straight up into the sky, to the point where it looked as if his plane must surely stall, then nonchalantly rolled to one side in a graceful arc and made a pinpoint landing, coming to a halt just before the doors of the hangar set aside for his arrival. All this in a plane with no brakes or forward visibility. The delighted roar of the crowd could be heard on Boston Common, 3 miles away. The center of Boston was a mass of people, the greatest throng that has ever gathered in this city to greet any man or body of men, in the words of one commentator. Though the crowd was good-natured, it was so vast and rolling as to be essentially beyond control. When the Lindbergh motorcade arrived at the Common, the mass instinctively surged forward for a better view. Such was the momentum, reported the correspondent for the New York Times, that those nearest the middle were lifted bodily from their feet by the human pressure. Many women and children fainted and were saved from serious injury because the very weight of others round them prevented them from falling to the ground and being trampled underfoot. Two soldiers and a policeman who tried to go to the aid of a woman who had fainted were themselves carried away, as if on a great tide. Others struggled not to be pushed under the wheels of the cautiously advancing motorcade. It was a wonder that many weren't crushed or asphyxiated. As it was, one man died of a heart attack, and over 100 were injured seriously enough to need treatment at field stations that had been set up around the Common. 14 people required hospitalization, and nearly everyone, according to the Times correspondent, returned home with bruised bodies and torn clothing. None of this would get better as the tour proceeded. Jostled, pounded on the back, tearfully adored, Charles Lindbergh was beginning to realize that this was not a passing thing. This was now his life. It must have seemed as if nothing could eclipse the intensity of interest in him. But in fact, something was about to, at least temporarily. In a prison nearby, close enough that those inside could clearly hear the cheers that greeted Lindbergh's arrival, 2 mild-mannered Italian anarchists sat on death row, awaiting execution for murders that millions of people across the planet were certain they did not commit. Their names were Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, and because of them, the world was about to light up once more. August, the Anarchists. I never know, never heard, even read in history, anything so cruel as this court. Nicola Sacco on being sentenced to death. Chapter 20. Just after 3 p.m. on a mild sunny afternoon in April 1920, 2 employees of the Slater and Morrill Shoe Company in South Braintree, Massachusetts, set off along a dusty sloping road from the company's offices on Railroad Avenue to a separate factory building about 200 yards away on Pearl Street. Frederick Parmenter was a payroll clerk. Alessandro Berardelli was his guard. They were carrying some $15,700 in cash in 2 metal boxes, the week's wages for 500 employees. Their route took them past another shoe factory, Rice and Hutchins, which occupied a 5-story building built hard by the road, giving it a dark and looming air. As Parmenter and Berardelli passed the Rice and Hutchins factory, 2 men who had been loitering nearby stepped forward and demanded the cash boxes. Before Berardelli could respond, one of the robbers shot him 3 times. Berardelli sank to his knees and fell forward onto his hands, head hanging. He coughed up blood and struggled to breathe. The gunman then turned to Parmenter, who was looking on aghast, and shot him. Stunned and gravely wounded, Parmenter dropped the cash box and staggered into the road in a reflexive attempt to get away. One of the robbers, it's not clear from witness accounts which it was, or even whether a 3rd gunman now appeared, followed Parmenter into the road, and calmly dropped him with a single shot in the back. A gunman, again witnesses could not agree which, turned to the crouching Berardelli and fired two shots into him from above, killing him. A blue car, containing two or possibly three other men, screeched up, collected the robbers and cash boxes, and sped off across the tracks of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad, firing at onlookers as it went. The entire incident lasted no more than a minute. It is testament to how swift and shocking the robbery was that witnesses could not agree even roughly on how many gunmen they saw or which did the shooting. No one would ever have guessed that this cold-blooded but fairly commonplace killing on a back lane of South Braintree would capture the world's attention. But what happened there that day made it the most consequential crime scene on Earth in the 1920s. Today, little remains from that afternoon. The factory buildings are long gone, as are the cafes and small businesses that stood scattered along the street. Braintree is no longer a factory town, but a pleasant suburb, 12 miles south of Boston. Pearl Street is a busy thoroughfare, with turning lanes and traffic lights on gantries above the road. Where Parmenter and Berardelli fell is the site of a neighborhood shopping center, Pearl Plaza, anchored by a Shaw supermarket and Office Max supply store. Beside a railroad bridge that wasn't there in 1927 is a small memorial to the two victims of the crime, erected in 2010 on the 90th anniversary of the robbery. Berardelli died at the scene. He was 45 years old and, like the two men eventually convicted of his killing, from Italy. He had worked for Slater and Morrill for about a year and left a wife and two children. Parmenter died at Quincy City Hospital the next morning. A devoted churchgoer who was popular with his workmates, he also left a wife and two children. That is about all that is known of the two victims. The getaway car, a stolen Buick, was found abandoned at a place called Manly Woods 2 days later. Police at that time were looking for the perpetrators of a similar botched holdup in nearby Bridgewater the previous Christmas Eve. Chief Michael E. Stewart of the Bridgewater Police Department decided, for reasons unattached to evidence, that the culprits in both cases were Italian anarchists. He discovered that a man of radical sympathies named Ferruccio Coacci lived near where the getaway car was found, and for that reason made him the chief suspect. As the New Yorker archly noted some time later, Stewart concluded that after a holdup and murder, the murderer would naturally abandon the car practically in his own front yard. Although Stewart was indeed the chief of police for Bridgewater, the title suggests a scale of operations that considerably exceeded the reality. Stewart's force was a single part-time assistant. Stewart himself had no training in investigating murders and almost no experience of serious crimes. That is no doubt why he investigated with such enthusiasm. This was the chance of a lifetime for him. Coacci was quickly eliminated as a suspect. He had gone back to Italy. Living in the house now was a man named Mario Buda, and Stewart, in his dogged way, transferred his suspicions to him. On learning that Buda had a car in for repairs in the Elm Square garage in West Bridgewater, Stewart left strict instructions with the proprietor to phone him the moment Buda called for it. One evening, 3 weeks later, that call came. The garage owner told Stewart that Buda and three other men had just come for the car, but had left directly because it wasn't ready. Buda and one man on a motorcycle with a sidecar, the other two on foot. The two on foot were thought to be traveling to Brockton by streetcar, so Stewart alerted the police there. When the streetcar reached Brockton, a policeman boarded it, surveyed the few passengers, and detained two uneasy-looking Italian men, Bart Vanzetti and Nicola Sacco. They were found to be carrying loaded pistols and a good deal of ammunition, some of it for guns other than the kinds they carried. They also possessed anarchist literature. For Chief Stewart, that was enough. Though neither man had been arrested for anything before, and though Stewart had no evidence to suggest that either man had been anywhere near South Braintree at the time of the murders, he had them charged. It was not a good time to be either a radical or an alien in America, and a positively dangerous time to be both. America was in the grip of something known as the Great Red Scare. In 1917 and 1918, Congress had enacted two startlingly restrictive laws, an Espionage Act and a Sedition Act. Together, these provided severe penalties for anyone found guilty of displaying almost any kind of disrespect to the American government, including its symbols, the flag, military uniforms, historic documents, or anything else in which was deemed to repose the glory and dignity of the United States of America. And these were imposed with a harsh and punitive zeal. Citizens were imprisoned for criticizing the Red Cross at their own dinner tables, one commentator noted. A clergyman in Vermont was given a 15-year jail term for handing out half a dozen pacifist leaflets. In Indiana, a jury took just 2 minutes to acquit a man who had shot an immigrant for speaking ill of America. Crazily, it became riskier to say disloyal things than to do them. A person who refused to obey the draft law could be imprisoned for 1 year, but a person who urged others to disobey the draft law could be imprisoned for 20 years. More than 1,000 citizens were jailed under the terms of the Espionage Act in its first 15 months. It was hard to know what could get you in trouble. A filmmaker named Robert Goldstein was imprisoned for showing the British in a bad light in a movie about the American War of Independence. The judge allowed that such a depiction would be permissible or even commendable in ordinary times, but in this hour of national emergency, Goldstein enjoyed no right to subvert the purposes and destiny of the nation. For insulting a foreign army from 150 years earlier, Goldstein was sentenced to 12 years in prison. Though the espionage and sedition laws were intended only as wartime measures, matters actually worsened with peace. The return home of 2 million job-seeking soldiers and the simultaneous dismantling of the wartime economy gave America a severe recession. Racial tensions erupted into riots in 24 cities where blacks had moved in search of better jobs. In Chicago, where the black population had doubled in a decade, a black youth who fell asleep on a raft on Lake Michigan and drifted onto a white beach was stoned to death by a white crowd, provoking 2 weeks of bitter rioting in which 38 people were killed and whole neighborhoods razed. At the same time, much of the nation was rocked by industrial unrest. Longshoremen, cloth workers, cigar makers, construction workers, steel workers, telephone operators, elevated rail and subway workers, coal miners, and even Broadway actors all walked off their jobs. At one point in 1919, 2 million people were out on strike. Foreign agitators and radical organizations like the Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies as the members were known, for reasons that have never been determined, were widely blamed for the troubles. In Boston and Cleveland, the police helped citizens beat up May Day paraders. Then the police in Boston went out on strike themselves, the event that propelled Calvin Coolidge to national prominence. In Washington State, Wesley Everest, an Industrial Workers of the World employee, was hauled into the street by a mob, which beat him and cut off his genitals. As he begged the mob to put him out of his misery, his tormentors took him to a city bridge, dangled him over the side on a rope, then shot him. His death was ruled a suicide. No charges were brought. At the height of the tumult, someone, a disgruntled alien it was presumed, began sending bombs. In Atlanta, a maid in the home of Senator Thomas R. Hardwick, head of the Senate Immigration Committee, had just taken delivery of a small brown package and was carrying it to the kitchen when it exploded, blowing off her hands. The next day, a New York postal employee read about the bombing and realized that the description of the parcel exactly matched 16 parcels he had put aside at a sorting office for insufficient postage. He rushed back to work and found the packages still there. All were addressed to prominent public figures, John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and several governors and congressmen. All bore return address labels to Gimbel Brothers Department Store at 32nd and Broadway in Manhattan. It was subsequently discovered that several other packages had already been posted. In one bizarre incident, a package was returned to Gimbel Brothers for insufficient postage. A Gimbel's clerk opened the package, examined the odd contents, bottle of acid, timer, explosives, then packed it all up again, added the necessary postage, and mailed it on. Altogether, 36 bombs were found. Apart from the unfortunate maid, no one else was injured, and no arrests were made. But that was not the end of it. Just over a month later, on a balmy evening in a quiet, well-to-do neighborhood of Washington, D.C., Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer and his wife were preparing to retire in their house at 2132 R Street Northwest when they heard a thump downstairs. As if something had been thrown against the front door, Palmer related afterwards. A moment later, the night was rent by a tremendous explosion, which blew out the front of the Palmer house and left every room open and exposed, like a doll's house. People in neighboring houses were thrown from their beds. Windows were broken for blocks around. Stumbling through the smoke and dust, the Palmers, both miraculously unhurt, went downstairs and stepped out onto an eerie scene of devastation. Blast debris was everywhere, hanging from trees, littering the street, strewn across lawns and rooftops. Much of it was still smoking. Scattered about in an unintentionally festive manner were anarchist leaflets. One of the first people on the scene was Assistant Secretary of the Navy Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who lived almost directly opposite. He had just parked and gone in after an evening out. The bomber had probably waited in the shadows for him to go, then proceeded to deposit the bomb. Had Roosevelt arrived a minute later, he might well have been killed, and America would have a different history. Roosevelt found Mr. and Mrs. Palmer whitened with plaster dust and wandering in shock. The Attorney General was speaking distractedly in the pronouns of his Quaker childhood, addressing his neighbors as thee and thou. It was clear that the bomber had been blown to pieces by his own device. Alice Longworth, Roosevelt's cousin, who was also present, reported that it was difficult to avoid stepping on bloody chunks of human being. One of the bomber's legs was found on a doorstep across the street. Another was found 50 feet away. A big section of torso, with clothing still attached, was found dangling from the cornice of a house on a neighboring street. Another indeterminate chunk of flesh and cartilage had crashed through the window of a house across the way and landed at the foot of the bed of Helmer Brin, Minister Plenipotentiary of Norway. Most of the scalp was found 2 blocks away on S Street. To reach that point, both distant and uphill, the top of the bomber's head must have been launched on a trajectory 100 feet high and 250 feet long. It was a big bomb. So many body parts were lying about that officials at first thought there had been 2 bombers, or perhaps 1 bomber and an unidentified innocent passerby. Clearly the bomb had gone off prematurely. The presumption was that the bomber had tripped as he was about to set it on the Palmer's steps. Before the night was out, newswires were clicking with reports that bombs of similar destructive magnitude had gone off in 7 other localities, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Paterson, New Jersey, and Newtonville, Massachusetts. Only 1 other person was killed, a night watchman in New York. But the knowledge that terrorists could mount coordinated violence on such a scale left many Americans distinctly unnerved. The bombs elsewhere were in some cases wholly mysterious, possibly because they had been delivered to the wrong houses. In Philadelphia, one of the bombs blew apart the house of a jeweler who had no connection to government or politics. Another severely damaged a Catholic church. Why the bombers targeted a Catholic church was never established. Thanks largely to the fact that the Washington bomber had been wearing a distinctive polka dot tie, detectives were able to identify him as Carlo Valdinocchi. This was a big loss to the anarchist movement. Though just 24, Valdinocchi had become a legend in the underground. Federal agents had recently tracked him to a house in West Virginia, but he had escaped just ahead of them, adding to his reputation for cunning and invincibility. Valdinocchi had been on the run since 1917, after an infamous bombing in Youngstown, Ohio. That bomb had not gone off as planned either. In fact, it had not gone off at all. So the police, in an act of unimaginable foolishness, took it to the station house and placed it on a table in the main operations room in order to examine it closely. As they tinkered with it, it exploded, killing 10 policemen and a woman who had come to report a robbery. The bombers were never caught, and the case was never solved. Radical cases rarely were. The bombings had a wondrous effect on the mind of A. Mitchell Palmer, a lantern-jawed Democrat from Pennsylvania. He had been Attorney General for just 3 months, but had already been the target of 2 bombs, a Gimbel's bomb that never reached him, and now this one that most assuredly did. This left him powerfully inclined to listen to a young advisor in the Justice Department who had developed a private theory that America's immigrant subversives, in league with international communists, were planning a coup. The young man's name was J. Edgar Hoover, and he convinced Palmer that the plotters existed in vast numbers and were planning an imminent strike. Hoover, who had only just graduated from law school, was put in charge of a hitherto inconsequential corner of the Alien Registration Section known as the Radical Division. He assembled an index file containing more than 200,000 names of individuals and organizations, all neatly cross-referenced. 40 translators were taken on to pore over radical publications, of which the tireless quantifier Hoover counted more than 600. Palmer had high hopes of becoming his party's presidential nominee in 1920. Dealing decisively with radical elements became his strategy for showing what a muscular individual he was. In a series of apocalyptic speeches, he warned that the flames of revolution were sweeping across the country, licking the altars of the churches, leaping into the belfry of the school bell, crawling into the sacred corners of American homes, seeking to replace marriage vows with libertine laws, burning up the foundations of society. Palmer claimed that some 5 million communists and fellow travelers were planning the overthrow of America. With his thrusting jaw and tough rhetoric, Palmer became known to his admirers as the Fighting Quaker. He had just launched what was quickly dubbed the Great Red Scare. Eagerly encouraged by J. Edgar Hoover, Palmer prepared a series of raids on radical gathering spots. The first was held on November 7, 1919, the second anniversary of the Russian Revolution, and mostly involved federal agents and police in 12 cities storming selected clubs and cafes, smashing furniture and arresting everyone in sight. In New York, police raided the Union of Russian Workers, beating anyone who protested or even questioned what they were doing. The Union was merely a social club, where members could go to play chess or take classes to improve their English. It had never had any connection to radical affairs. In Hartford, Connecticut, police arrested a large number of suspects, the exact number is uncertain, then arrested anyone who came to ask after them. In Detroit, an entire orchestra and all the patrons of a particular restaurant were among 800 detainees who were held for up to a week in a windowless corridor without adequate water, toilets, or space to lie down. Eventually, all were released without charge. Palmer was so pleased with the publicity his raids generated and the fear they instilled that he ordered a second, larger set of raids in the new year. This time, some 6,000 to 10,000 people, accounts vary widely, were arrested in at least 78 cities in 23 states. Again, there was much needless destruction of property, arrests without warrants, and beating of innocent people. The Great Red Scare proved not to be so scary after all. In total, the authorities seized just 3 pistols and no explosives. No evidence of a national conspiracy was ever uncovered. The failure to catch any bombers or unearth a conspiracy ended Palmer's political prospects. At the Democratic Convention in 1920, the delegates selected James M. Cox, governor of Ohio, to run against another Ohioan, Warren G. Harding. Although the Palmer raids didn't achieve anything, they had a powerful effect on national sentiment, which is almost certainly why Chief Stewart of Bridgewater decided, without benefit of evidence, that the murderers on his patch were foreign anarchists. And it is why Sacco and Vanzetti never really stood a chance. Between 1905 and 1914, 10 million people, mostly from southern and eastern Europe, poured into America, a country that had only 83 million people to begin with. The numbers of immigrants changed the face of urban America utterly. By 1910, immigrants and the children of immigrants made up almost three-quarters of the populations of New York, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, and Boston. Sacco and Vanzetti were among 130,000 Italians who arrived in 1908 alone. Sacco, from Torre Maggiore in southeastern Italy, was just 16 years old on arrival. Vanzetti, who came from the more prosperous northern Piedmont, not far from France, was 3 years older. Neither would ever see his homeland again. Though both settled in New England, they would not meet until 1917. Sacco was small, lithe, and handsome, clean-cut as a Roman coin, in the words of one contemporary. Descriptions make him sound rather like the young Al Pacino, small, good-looking, quiet-spoken. He didn't drink or gamble. He got a job in a shoe factory and soon was a skilled craftsman on good wages. 4 years after his arrival in America, he married and started a family. At the time of his arrest, he was 30 years old and a good, hard-working family man. He didn't seem an obvious candidate for anarchy. Vanzetti was a different matter. Though he had trained as a pastry chef, a respectable profession, in Italy, in America he worked as a common laborer at the lowest wages, almost as if he were seeking out privation to prove a point about the evils of capitalism. He was frequently unemployed, always hard up, and occasionally near starvation. In the spring of 1919, however, his economic circumstances, and, it would seem, his entrepreneurial spirit, took a sudden turn for the better when he bought a fish cart, complete with knives, weighing scales, and a bell for attracting custom, and became a mobile fish vendor in Plymouth, Massachusetts. At the time of his arrest, he was 33 years old and doing rather well. Vanzetti was an intellectual by nature. He read a great deal and lived quietly and soberly. He never had a girlfriend. He had a melancholy air and a sad, gentle smile. His eyes had a tenderness that haunted one friend recalled. His most conspicuous attribute, after 1917, was a vast, drooping mustache. Although his manner was affable and even sweet-natured, he was a bitter foe of the state. Vanzetti was anarchism personified, one associate said. Vanzetti and Sacco were not especially great friends. They lived 30 miles apart, Sacco in Staunton, near Bridgewater, and Vanzetti in Plymouth, and had known each other for less than 3 years, when they became eternally yoked by the payroll murders in South Braintree. Arrested and taken in for questioning, they didn't do it all well. They were unable to explain why they needed to be so extravagantly armed for a visit to a car repair shop. They claimed not to know Buddha or the other man, and said they knew no one with a motorcycle, lies that were easily disproven. They denied that they were anarchists and offered inconsistent and unpersuasive explanations for what had brought them to West Bridgewater. The suspicion has always been that they were there to move illicit materials, possibly explosives, possibly anarchist literature, and didn't wish to incriminate themselves. Buddha and the fourth man, subsequently identified as Riccardo Orciani, were arrested and brought in for questioning but released. Orciani, because he could prove he was at work at the time of both robberies, and Buddha, who was very short and stocky, because he did not fit any of the witness descriptions. By default, therefore, Sacco and Vanzetti became the chief and only suspects, even though neither had a criminal record or links to any criminal gangs. All that the police had against them was that they were armed and untruthful when arrested. Nearly all the evidence pointed away from them. They were the mildest of men. Nothing in their natures suggested the least capacity for violence. They had never even been known to raise their voices. No evidence of any kind, such as fingerprints on the stolen car, placed them at the scene of the crime. Three witnesses, shown photographs, identified one of the gunmen as Anthony Pomisano. But Pomisano, it turned out, had been in prison in Buffalo since the previous January. At least two witnesses said that the principal gunman had a pencil-thin mustache, whereas Sacco had none, and Vanzetti was famous for the luxuriant, drooping shag that all but covered his mouth. When Sacco and Vanzetti were paraded before witnesses, they were not presented as part of a lineup, as procedures required, but shown individually to the witnesses, to whom it was made clear that these were the prime suspects. Even so, the woman who would be one of the chief witnesses at the subsequent trial failed to identify Sacco or Vanzetti when standing right in front of them. No one at first saw their arrest as a big story. A reporter from New York, sent to Massachusetts to look into the story, reported back to his editor, "There's nothing in it, just a couple of wops in a jam." In Boston, the big story in the spring of 1920 was how the Red Sox would do in their first season without Babe Ruth. Vanzetti, to his astonishment, was charged not just with the Braintree crime, but also with the earlier one at the L.Q. White Shoe Company factory in Bridgewater on Christmas Eve 1919. Sacco was not charged because he was able to produce a time card showing he was at work that day. Vanzetti was not short of alibis himself. 30 witnesses testified that they had seen, talked to, or conducted business with him from his fish cart in Plymouth that day. Eels are a traditional Christmas dish for many Italians, so people remembered buying eels from him on the day before Christmas. Such evidence as was brought against Vanzetti was hardly the most persuasive. A witness, aged 14, when asked how he knew one of the robbers was a foreigner, replied, "I could tell by the way he ran." The jury convicted him anyway, evidently discounting all the witness testimony on his behalf, in the belief that all the wops stick together, as Vanzetti himself remarked bitterly afterwards. Had a Protestant minister or school principal testified in Vanzetti's favor, he would probably have been cleared. But unfortunately, such people didn't buy eels on Christmas Eve. A quotation often attributed to Judge Webster Thayer at the Vanzetti trial was, "This man, although he may not actually have committed the crime attributed to him, is nevertheless morally culpable, because his ideals are cognate with crime." It has been quoted many times, but in fact the statement is not in the trial transcript, and no evidence exists that Thayer ever said such a thing. It was clear, however, that he had little sympathy for anarchists. He sentenced Vanzetti to 12 to 15 years in prison, an unusually stiff sentence for a man with no criminal record. To many observers, this was clearly a travesty, and the second trial would make matters far worse. For Italian immigrants of the early 20th century, America often came as a shock. As the historians Leonard Dinnerstein and David M. Reimers have observed, most were unprepared for the coolness with which so many Americans received them. Often they found themselves excluded from employment and educational opportunities because of their nationality. Restrictive covenants kept them from moving into certain neighborhoods. Italians who settled in the Deep South were sometimes made to attend black schools. At first, it was by no means clear that they would be allowed to use white drinking fountains and lavatories. Other immigrant groups, Greeks, Turks, Poles, Slavs, Jews of every nation, encountered similar prejudice, of course. And for Asians and America's own blacks, prejudice and restrictions were even more imaginative and cruel. But the Italians were widely regarded as something of a special case, more voluble and temperamental and troublesome than other ethnic groups. Wherever problems arose, Italians seemed to be at the heart of things. The widespread perception of Italians was that if they weren't fascists or Bolsheviks, they were anarchists or communists, and if they weren't those, they were involved in organized crime. Footnote. In fact, and this can't be said quickly enough, Italians were not unlawful. Italians in 1910 constituted 11% of the immigrant population, but accounted for 7% of foreign-born people in prison. As John Kobler notes, in terms of imprisonment rates per 100,000 of population, the Italians came 12th out of 17 nationalities. Even the New York Times declared in an editorial that it was perhaps hopeless to think of civilizing Italians or keeping them in order, except by the arm of the law. University of Wisconsin sociologist E. A. Ross insisted that crime in Italy had fallen only because all the criminals are here. This was precisely the prejudice that Ruth Snyder and Judd Gray hoped to exploit when they created a pair of imaginary Italian anarchists as the supposed murderers of her husband. For working-class Italians, assimilation was often a forlorn hope. Millions lived within, but quite separate from, the rest of America. It is a telling point that after 12 years in the country, Sacco and Vanzetti still barely spoke English. The transcript of their trial shows that both men did not fully understand questions put to them or what was being said by others. Even when they grasped the gist of matters, they struggled to express themselves. As someone remarked, it was not so much that they spoke English with an Italian accent as that they spoke Italian using English words. Here is a short specimen of Sacco trying to explain from the witness stand how he could be an anarchist and yet claim to love America. When I came to this country, I saw there was not what I was thinking before, but there was all the difference, because I'd been working in Italy not so hard as I'd been work in this country. I could live free there just as well, work in the same condition but not so hard, about 7 or 8 hours a day, better food. I mean genuine. Of course, over here is good food, because it is bigger country, to any of those who got money to spend, not for the working and laboring class, and in Italy is more opportunity to laborer to eat vegetable, more fresh, and I came in this country. This poor command of English was widely regarded as proof that Italians were lazy and irremediably backward. Many Americans were sincerely bewildered and affronted, not altogether without reason, it must be said, to think that the nation had flung open its doors to the tired and poor of Europe to give them the chance of a better life, only to have that generosity repaid with strikes, the planting of bombs, and the fomenting of rebellions. Sacco and Vanzetti became the living symbols of that ingratitude. A common view among Americans at the time was that even if they were innocent of the Braintree crimes, they still deserved to be punished. As the foreman of the jury in their case reportedly remarked early in the trial, "Damn them, they ought to hang anyway." 5 days after indictments were handed down against Sacco and Vanzetti in Massachusetts, a horse-drawn wagon pulled up outside the head offices of J.P. Morgan and Company at the corner of Broad and Wall Streets in Manhattan. The driver, it is supposed, tethered the horse and departed sharply. For a few moments later, the cart exploded with a force that rocked the district and blew out windows on the 32nd floor of a building more than a block away. The bomb was a particularly vicious one. Packed with shrapnel, it was designed to maim and was detonated when the street was packed with lunchtime office workers. 30 people were killed instantly and several hundred injured. The heat of the blast was so intense that many of the victims suffered severe burns on top of any other injuries. A clerk at J.P. Morgan was decapitated at his desk by a sheet of flying glass, but no senior members of the firm, the presumed principal targets, were among the victims. J.P. Morgan himself was out of the country. The other Morgan partners, including Charles Lindbergh's future father-in-law, Dwight Morrow, were meeting in a room that had no windows on the blast side of the building, so were securely shielded. At the end of the day, the casualty totals were 38 dead and 143 gravely injured. Among the luckiest people outside was Joseph P. Kennedy, father of the future president, who was close enough to be blown off his feet, but far enough away not to be seriously hurt. Morgan, as a point of pride, opened for business the next day. Rewards of $100,000 were offered for information leading to a conviction, but no one came forward who could describe the bomber or offer any other useful leads. Detectives and federal officials interviewed every blacksmith east of Chicago and visited more than 4,000 stables in the hope of identifying the horse, cart, or horseshoes involved in the bomb. The shrapnel had been made from sash weights, so they contacted every sash weight dealer and manufacturer in America to try to find where the slugs came from. For 3 years, detectives worked on the case. Not a single helpful fact emerged. No one was ever charged. In 1991, the historian Paul Average, in Sacco and Vanzetti, The Anarchist Background, probably the most exhaustive book ever written on the case, declared that he had it on good but unspecified evidence that the bomber was Mario Buda, the man who had been with Sacco and Vanzetti on the evening of their arrest. At the time, however, Buda was not known to the police in New York and was not suspected or interviewed. Whether part of the bombing or not, he returned to Naples in a curious hurry soon after the bomb went off. It later also emerged that Nicola Sacco had been close friends with Carlo Valdinoci, and that Valdinoci's sister had come to live in Sacco's house after her brother died in the Palmer House bombing in Washington. Sacco and Vanzetti, it seems, may not have been quite so innocent as history has wished to make them. The trial of Sacco and Vanzetti for the murders and payroll robbery at South Braintree began on May 31, 1921, Judge Webster Thayer presiding once again. Thayer was a gaunt, pale figure in his 60s. He had a hawk nose, thin mouth, and white moustache. He was only 5 feet 2 inches tall, but had been a star athlete in his youth and had nearly become a professional baseball player. He went through life with a small chip on his shoulder because he was a butcher's son in a state where pedigree counted for a lot. The trial lasted almost 7 weeks, heard from about 160 witnesses, and produced over 2,000 pages of testimony. According to the state's case, Sacco and another unidentified man did the hold-up and shooting. No attempt was made to track down or identify the other gunman, or any of the other participants in the robbery. The state seemed oddly content to pin the whole thing on Sacco and Vanzetti. Vanzetti, even in the worst scenario, was merely a passenger in the getaway car, and only one witness confidently put him there. 44 others swore they saw him elsewhere that day, selling fish in Plymouth for the most part, or declared him not to have been among the culprits. A group in Providence, known as the Morelli Gang, actually had a history of robbing shoe factories, but the police did not investigate them. None of the robbery money was ever found or in any way connected to Sacco or Vanzetti. The prosecution offered no theories as to what had become of it. No attempt was made to find or identify the other three men involved in the robbery. Much of the testimony against the accused was pretty dubious. Louis Pelzer, a factory worker, testified that he saw Sacco shoot Berardelli, but he had originally told police that he had dived under a table when he heard gunfire and hadn't seen anything. Three of his co-workers testified that he had never looked out of the window. Mary Splain, a key witness, said she looked out of a window just as the getaway car sped away. Her view lasted for no more than 3 seconds and was from a distance of between 60 and 80 feet. Yet at the trial, she was able to recount 16 details about Sacco's appearance, including the shade of his eyebrows and the length of his hair at the neck. She even stated with certainty Sacco's height, even though she had only ever seen him seated in a moving automobile. 13 months earlier, she had failed to identify Sacco at all when viewing him in person from close range. Sacco had once briefly worked at the Rice and Hutchins factory, and several of its employees remembered him, but none except Mary Splain said that Nicola Sacco was one of those present. Just one witness placed Vanzetti at the scene at the time of the murder, as a passenger in the getaway car. None suggested that he fired a gun or was otherwise directly involved. In his summing up to the jury, Judge Thayer laid great stress on what the legal profession called consciousness of guilt, Sacco and Vanzetti's suspiciously evasive behavior under questioning. Innocent people, Thayer stressed, did not need to fabricate answers. Ergo, they were guilty. The jury agreed. After 5.5 hours of deliberation on July 14, 1921, it pronounced Sacco and Vanzetti guilty. The sentence was death by electrocution. It cannot be said that the state rushed to execute them. Appeals went on for 6 years. Sacco and Vanzetti's defense team submitted 7 motions for retrial on the grounds that Judge Thayer was biased and the trial not fair, and lodged 2 further appeals with the Massachusetts Supreme Court. All were denied. In 1925, Celestino Medeiros, a native of the Azores who was on death row for another crime, issued a confession. "I hereby confess to being in the South Braintree Shoe Company crime, and Sacco and Vanzetti was not in said crime," he wrote. Under questioning, Medeiros proved vague about crucial details of the Braintree robbery, the time of day it took place, for instance, and Thayer dismissed the confession as untrustworthy, which in fact it was. Thayer also issued a detailed 25,000-word statement explaining why he had dismissed all calls for a retrial. The first signals of angry dissent arose not in America, but in France. On October 20, 1921, a bomb was sent to Ambassador Myron Herrick in a package disguised to look like a gift. By remarkable good fortune, the package was inadvertently activated by one of the few people in Paris who could recognize it for what it was and had the forbearance to respond accordingly. Herrick's English valet, Lawrence Blanchard, had worked with bombs in the First World War and recognized the whirring sound within the package as a Mills hand grenade. He hurled the package into the ambassador's bathroom an instant before it detonated. The explosion destroyed the bathroom and felled Blanchard with a piece of shrapnel to the leg, but he was otherwise unhurt. Had Herrick opened the package himself, another ambassador would have greeted Charles Lindbergh in Paris in 1927. A few days later, another bomb, possibly an accidental detonation, at a Sacco-Vanzetti rally, killed 20 people. In the following 2 weeks, bombs exploded at American embassies or consular offices in Lisbon, Rio de Janeiro, Zurich, and Marseille. In America, writers and intellectuals were the first to protest the convictions, notably the novelists Upton Sinclair and John Dos Passos, the short story writer Catherine Ann Porter, the poet Edna St. Vincent Millay, the critic Lewis Mumford, the newspaperman Heywood Broun, and several members of the Algonquin Roundtable, including Dorothy Parker and Robert Benchley. Most of them were at one time or another arrested and charged with loitering and sauntering, an offense peculiar to Boston, it seems. Benchley additionally swore that he had overheard Thayer boasting in the golf club at Worcester, Massachusetts, that he would get those bastards good and proper, which agitated liberal opinion further. Petitions appealing for a retrial poured in from abroad. One had almost 500,000 signatures, another more than 150,000. Streets and cafes throughout the world were renamed for the two Italians. In Argentina, a brand of cigarettes was called Sacco y Vanzetti, as was a popular tango. The involvement of intellectuals and foreigners stirred sharp resentment in some quarters. Working men, mostly Irish, held counter-demonstrations in Boston, calling for the swift execution of the two Italians. According to the writer Francis Russell, who lived through the period as a boy in Boston, public opinion was mostly against Sacco and Vanzetti. In particular, middle-class Republicans believed in their guilt. Senator William Borah of Idaho, chairman of the Committee on Foreign Relations, said, "It would be a national humiliation, a shameless, cowardly compromise of national courage to pay the slightest attention to foreign protests," which he called impudent and willful. The real turning point for many was when future Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, then a law professor at Harvard, looked into the case and became convinced that Sacco and Vanzetti had been railroaded. Frankfurter detailed his objections in the March 1927 issue of the Atlantic Monthly. "I assert with deep regret, but without the slightest fear of disproof, that certainly in modern times Judge Thayer's opinion stands unmatched for discrepancies between what the record discloses and what the opinion conveys," he wrote. His 25,000-word document cannot accurately be described otherwise than as a farrago of misquotations, misrepresentations, suppressions, and mutilations. The opinion is literally honeycombed with demonstrable errors, and a spirit alien to judicial utterance permeates the whole. Frankfurter systematically and persuasively demolished the case against Sacco and Vanzetti, but his findings were not welcomed by the Boston establishment. Many Harvard alumni demanded that he be fired. Colleagues and old friends snubbed him. He found that when he walked into a room or restaurant, some people would get up and leave. The article, it was said, cost Harvard $1 million in donations. But elsewhere, anger and a sense of injustice seemed to be on the increase. Among those who asked for a new trial were Berardelli's widow. The conservative Boston Herald, which had previously supported execution, reversed its opinion after reading Thayer's statement. No one gave more attention to the case than Massachusetts Governor Alvin T. Fuller. Fuller appears to have been a thoroughly decent man. He began adult life as a bicycle salesman, then went to Paris and brought back two of the first automobiles ever imported into North America. Eventually, he became sole New England distributor for Packard, at a time when Packards were the best cars in the country. The relationship made him a millionaire many times over. He lived in a Boston mansion and collected 18th-century English paintings, Gainsborough's and Romney's in particular. In 14 years as an elected official, he never took a paycheck. On May 10, 1927, just at the time that Neungesser and Coley went missing, a bomb was mailed to Fuller, but luckily was intercepted and defused. In the same month, Fuller appointed a commission of three worthies: Abbot Lawrence Lowell, president of Harvard, Samuel Stratton, president of MIT, and Robert Grant, a retired judge, to consider formally whether Sacco and Vanzetti had been given a fair trial and should be executed. They were not young. Grant was 75, Lowell 71, and Stratton 66. Fuller at the same time made a private study of the case. He read every word of the transcript. He had all the physical evidence, pistols, bullets, articles of clothing, sent to his house so that he could study them. He called in and personally questioned all of the 11 surviving jurors. One had died, as well as witnesses from both trials. He several times devoted 12 to 14-hour days to doing nothing else but studying the Sacco-Vanzetti case. He twice interviewed Sacco and Vanzetti, and even the hapless Celestino Medeiros, as well as members of their families. Fuller found himself particularly taken with Vanzetti. In prison, Vanzetti had studied English by correspondence course, and his language skills had improved enormously. In his later years in prison, he wrote many moving and articulate letters and essays, and struck everyone with his sensitivity and intelligence. Vanzetti's lawyer, Fred Moore, said he had never met a man of such splendid gentility. Governor Fuller, after their first meeting, came out gushing. What an attractive man! On the day of Lindbergh's visit to Boston in July, Fuller went first to Charlestown Prison to meet with the convicted men. He spent 15 minutes each with Sacco and Medeiros, but a full hour with Vanzetti. It was clear to everyone that Fuller wished not to execute the men, Vanzetti in particular. At about the time of Lindbergh's visit, the Lowell Commission, as it was known, revealed its findings. It concluded that Sacco was guilty beyond any doubt, Vanzetti probably so, and that there were no grounds for a reprieve. Anger among liberals was almost immeasurable. Heywood Broun called it legalized murder and wrote, "It is not every prisoner who has a president of Harvard University throw the switch for him." That was that for Sacco and Vanzetti. On August 3rd, Fuller announced with implicit regret that he could find no grounds for clemency and that the executions must proceed. Sacco and Vanzetti would be taken to the electric chair the following week. The news did not cause quite the stir that might have been predicted, and this was almost entirely because President Coolidge, in far-off South Dakota, had just dumbfounded the nation with an unexpected announcement of his own. Chapter 21. The 2nd of August was a cold, wet day in South Dakota. The 30 or so members of the Presidential Press Corps were surprised to find themselves summoned to Rapid City High School for a special announcement at noon. Ushered into a classroom, they were even more surprised to find President Coolidge sitting at a teacher's desk. It was the 4th anniversary of Warren Harding's death, and so also of Calvin Coolidge's assumption of the presidency. Coolidge looked inscrutably pleased about something. The reporters were instructed to form a line. As each man filed past the desk, Coolidge handed him a 2-inch by 9-inch strip of paper bearing the message, "I do not choose to run for president in 1928. That was all. The decision caught everyone by surprise. A bolt from the blue would not be too extravagant a term to describe the Coolidge cryptogram, wrote Robert Benchley in The New Yorker. Even Grace Coolidge, the First Lady, was apparently unaware of her husband's decision and learned the news afterwards from one of those present. Coolidge spoke just 5 words at the press conference. "Is everyone here now?" before it started, and "No," when asked if he would comment further on his announcement. Then the reporters rushed out to break the news to the world. The message itself was either 10 words or 12 words long, depending on whether one counted 1928 as one word or three. No one could agree. But the correspondents, filing reports from the Western Union office in Rapid City, sent nearly 100,000 words that day and the next. Why Coolidge decided not to run is a question that has fed speculation for over 80 years. Probably there were many reasons. Both he and his wife had no fondness for Washington, particularly in the sapping mugginess of summer, which was why he was pleased to take such a long vacation in 1927. Nor was it as if he had a great program to see through. Whatever mark Calvin Coolidge was going to leave on the world was unlikely to be altered by another 4 years in office. Coolidge also seems to have enjoyed a certain prescience regarding the economy. "Papa says there's a depression coming," Grace Coolidge remarked to an acquaintance soon after her husband announced his decision. But there was one other reason, nowhere noted at the time, that may have stood out above all others. Calvin Coolidge was depressed, chronically so. The reason was a family tragedy for which he blamed himself. 3 years earlier, on the last day of June 1924, Coolidge's two sons, John and Calvin Jr., had a game of tennis on a White House court. Calvin Jr. wore sneakers without socks and developed a blister, which became infected. Within a day or so, he was running a high fever and was drifting in and out of delirium. On July 3rd, the day before his father's birthday, he was hurriedly admitted to Walter Reed General Hospital. Coolidge wrote to his father, "Calvin is very sick. He blistered his toe and infection got into his blood. The toe looks all right, but the poison spread all over his system. Of course, he has all that medical science can give, but he may have a long sickness with ulcers. Then again, he may be better in a few days." In fact, 3 days later, the boy was dead. Coolidge had been president for just over 11 months and had been nominated to run for president in his own right just 2 weeks earlier. Coolidge and his wife were devastated. All interest in affairs of state seemed to drain out of the president. "When he went, the power and the glory of the presidency went with him," Coolidge wrote later. Coolidge was convinced that his role as president was entirely responsible for his son's death. He wrote in his autobiography, "If I had not been president, he would not have raised a blister on his toe, which resulted in blood poisoning, playing lawn tennis in the South grounds. I do not know why such a price was exacted for occupying the White House." The final sentence of Coolidge's autobiography was strangely heartfelt. "It costs a great deal to be president." Among the nation's press, the question concerning the president's announcement was not why he decided not to run, but why he chose such an ambiguous phrase as "I do not choose to run," as opposed to a more direct "I choose not to run," or "I have decided not to run." Many saw it not as an outright refusal to run, but almost as the very opposite, a reluctant willingness to be drafted, if that was the will of the people. The humorist Will Rogers put it succinctly in his popular newspaper column, "I think Mr. Coolidge's statement is the best-worded acceptance of a nomination ever uttered by a candidate. He spent a long time in the dictionary looking for that word choose instead of I will not. It don't take much political knowledge to know that a man can get more votes running on the people's request than he can running on his own request. Mr. Coolidge is the shrewdest politician that ever drew government salary." The person in America most excited by the announcement was Herbert Hoover, who saw himself as the clear frontrunner to succeed Coolidge, even if the rest of the nation did not, or at least did not necessarily. Hoover was vacationing in the redwood forests of Northern California when the news broke, and was as puzzled as everyone else by Coolidge's choice of words. "The word choose has various connotations in its New England usage," he reflected later. "I determined at once to say nothing until I could have a talk with the president." According to Hoover's memoirs of 1952, he waited till both he and Coolidge were back in Washington in September, though other sources say they met sooner. When at last they caught up, Hoover, looking for clarity, and perhaps even a kind of blessing, asked if Coolidge thought he should run. To which all Coolidge would say was, "Why not?"